In the star systems of the universe around us, there is a far greater danger than Brigantes. We are fighting a dangerous battle, a bigger battle. We have made a mistake, and it has resulted in the death of this innocent boy. I killed his murderer. We cannot undo the mistake, but we must go on. In that trench there, 67 cadets died, fighting the last battle of the Cyclo invasion over 1,000 years ago. When I first saw that trench, it gave me my first hope. It was not that they lost. It was that they fought it all against hopeless odds. They did not die in vain. We are here. We are fighting again. You and your fellow pilots control the skies of Earth. I will make a request of one or another of you in times to come. Will you honor those requests? There was a masked stare. Did he think they would not? Then there was a concerted roar of assent. It took minutes for it to quiet. Johnny said, I am leaving you now. I am taking this boy to Scotland, to be buried by his own people. Johnny got down off the car. The pilot, whose ore carrier had been readied for the Russians, was pointing it out to the Russian coordinator. They loaded Johnny's horses. They found Stormalong's kit in the ground car and put it aboard. The Russians took over the body of Dmitry Tomlov to take it home. Johnny climbed to the cockpit of the big ore carrier, still holding Biddy. Before he closed the door, he looked down at the crowd and said, slowly and clearly, It is not the time for revenge. And then he added a bitter, grim, yet. The crowd nodded. They understood. Later it would be an entirely different matter. The huge plane rose and turned in the gray, storm-discolored sky. It dwindled and was gone. 10. A much more serious crisis awaited him in Scotland, one that threatened to wreck all his plans. Pilots on the ground talked the ore plane down through the dark swirling mists of autumn. The Scots had begun to rebuild Castle Rock in Edinburgh, cleaning up and trying to restore the ancient buildings that 2,000 years before had been the seat of Scottish nationalism and that was now being called its original Gaelic word, Dunedin, the hill fort of Eden. Johnny landed in a park below the rock, just in front of the ruins of the ancient National Gallery of Scotland. Swarms of people had been there to meet him, and Gillies had been hard-pressed to clear space in the throng for the plane to land. Unfortunately, the drone pictures of the compound fight had come in on the Cornwall minesite recorders, and they had been rushed by mine passenger plane to Scotland long before Johnny's arrival. The Scots were making good use of the vast amounts of transport taken from the cyclos, and flatbeds were being used as buses now that trainee machine operators were back home. Biddy's mother and family were there, and Johnny gave over the corpse to them to dress and prepare for a funeral. Pipers were wailing a lament, drums beating its slow and doleful cadence. Women in the crowd were openly crying, and men were beating their fists together as they dwelt on what they conceived to be the necessity of war. It was nearly dark. An honor guard of kilted Highlanders approached, and its officer courteously told Johnny he was there to escort him through the crowds to a meeting of the chiefs. They had not yet restored the Parliament House on the rock. The chiefs, brought hastily in from the hills, were meeting in the nearby open park before the ruined Royal Scottish Academy. To the mournful cry of pipes, Johnny walked toward the space. It was lit with a towering bonfire in its center. The flame's glow was flickering over the buckles and swords of clan chiefs and their retainers. It was an assembly with only one single-minded purpose: war. Belatedly, Robert the Fox, just in from Africa, rushed to Johnny's side. They were already on the outskirts of the assembly, the honor guard opening the way, heading for some raised stone slabs that served as a rostrum. Clan Chief Fergus was coming forward in courtesy to escort him to this rostrum.
"Do you want war?" said Robert the Fox into Johnny's ear. "I think not. It would ruin all your plans."
"No, no," said Johnny. "That is the last thing we want. Without it, we have a chance.
Then why, said Sir Robert, didn't you change your clothes before this meeting? You might have known it would take place.
Johnny had not thought about his clothes. He glanced down. The buckskin shoulder was dark red from the bleeding of the superficial wound at the side of his neck, long since staunched by coagulation. The entire front of his shirt and his trousers down to the knee were saturated with Biddy's blood. At that very moment, the chief of the Campbells was speaking to the assembled chiefs.
And I say, this is a blood feud that can only be settled in war.
There was a savage roar of agreement.
War! War!
Lochaber axes were flashing in the light of the leaping flames. The slither of swords coming from their sheaths was a deadly martial declaration. Johnny stepped up on the stone rostrum. He held up his hand for quiet. They gave him a silence electric with tension and punctuated by the crackling flame of the bonfire.
We want no war, said Johnny.
It was the wrong thing to say. A clamor of disagreement rolled at him.
By the very blood on his clothes, shouted the chief of the Argyles, this cries out for war.
The murderer of the boy is dead, said Johnny.
What of Alison?
Cried the chief of the Camerons.
His vile murder has not been avenged. The chief of the Brigantes, he that brought it about, still lives. These are matters of blood feud.
Johnny realized they were out of control. They were demanding pilots and transport. Their target was the obliteration of the entire force of Brigantes. And now. He knew this had all been decided before his arrival on the slow ore carrier. He could see all their labors going for nothing. If that area in America were wiped out, that would end their plans. He looked for the face of Robert the Fox and found only this sea of enraged chiefs and retainers. He did not dare tell them so openly and in public of his plans. Lars had shown there could be traitors. He tried to tell them the planet was under a much greater threat, that they did not really know what had happened to Cyclo, that there were other races out in the stars. But not one single word he said was heard in the tumult. Finally, the big and lordly chief of Clan Fergus leaped up beside him and bellowed at the throng,
Let the MacTyler speak!
They quieted under that, tense, determined. Johnny was tired. He had not slept for days. He summoned up reserves of energy and spoke in a strong, confident voice.
I can promise you successful war, if you will let me guide you, if you will each one contribute men and time to a daring enterprise, if you will but plan with me and work in preparation for the next few months, we will have war, we will have revenge, and we will have a chance of everlasting victory.
They heard that. After a moment, while it sank in, they burst into a savage din of agreement. The Lochaber axes were raised higher. Claymores flashed back the light of flames. The pipes suddenly burst into the stirring tunes of war. They hailed Johnny until they were hoarse. As he stepped down and was led away by Robert the Fox, big hands clapped him on the back as he passed. Others sought to grip his. Men leaped before him, claymores held before their faces in devoted salutes. Somebody started a chant of,
MacTyler! MacTyler! MacTyler!
The pipes screamed and drums added to the din.
Count on you, laddie, said Robert the Fox fondly, as he led Johnny off to temporary quarters in an old house, a bath, clean clothes, and rest. But I'm only hoping we can deliver.
They buried Biddy MacLeod the next day in a crypt in the old Cathedral St. Giles. The funeral procession was over a mile long. To the chief of Clan Fergus, Johnny had said, He died as squire. We must bury him as a knight. Placing a robe on the corpse, Fergus, as titular king of Scotland, and now the entire British Isles, knighted Biddy with a tender touch of a sword. A rock carver had worked straight through to complete a sarcophagus, a stone casket, and it was ready. The parson read the funeral oration, and to the doleful mourn of pipes, Biddy was laid away.
On the plaque, beneath the new armorial bearings they had given Biddy, was carved, "Sir Biddy, a true knight." They knew Biddy would have liked that. Patty, her face frozen in shock since she had first heard the news of his death, at the funeral's end was given the small packet they had found in his pocket. It was the locket. She numbly read the engraving on it. "To Patty, my future wife." The dam of her tears broke, and she collapsed across the sarcophagus, weeping uncontrollably. But Biddy was not really gone. He had become a legend. Future generations, if they survived, would hold in song and story the memory of Sir Biddy, who they said had saved the life of Johnny. Chapter 21. 1. The spacecraft Ocnar 2 rode in orbit 421 miles above the planet Earth. The small gray man sat in a small gray office in the ship. He was looking at small gray instruments. He was only partly finished with a critical analysis, and he was not even vaguely satisfied with it. A bottle of pills sat on his desk, pills for indigestion. His job had its drawbacks. Drinking all manner of hospitable offerings, including yarb tea, had upset his stomach. The small gray man was deeply troubled. The problems which assailed such a position as his were never easy. They required the most conservative possible judgment. He had faced many situations in his long life, a large number of them involving the most dangerous and overwhelming elements. But at no time, he did a hasty calculation with a rolling calculator, in 313,000 years, had he or his predecessors ever been confronted with the ruin potential of this one. He sighed and took another indigestion pill. This last packet of information that his communicator had given him contained elements which defied even the most expert mathematical dissection and reassembly. There were explosive elements in all this which could well wreak havoc. For one thing, a lightning storm had grossly interfered with the clarity of the first item. An infrabeam sound transmitter, no matter how narrowly it could be focused, was, after all, an electronic device, and interference was not only possible, it had happened. He considered himself no technician. That was not his role. But his technicians aboard could not get it clarified either. Compounding his trouble was this delay in all communications to competent labs. He was 2.5 months in travel time away from any such help. Wearily, he ran the data of the first item through the display machine for the 7th time. There was the compound, the old central cyclo mine site of the planet. There were some men in hiding behind rocks holding weapons. There was the arrival of the car, the departure of the first man into the compound. Then 3 men getting out of the car, 2 of them with weapons held on the third. He had tried and tried to get a clearer picture of the third man, but the interference due to the lightning was really bad. He once more got out one of the several one-credit bank notes he had managed to procure and studied the picture. But he could not be sure it was the same man. It was useless to call in a technician again. He had already done that. He let the signal decode into running visual again and spin forward. Then there came this second car, truck. A small figure leaping out holding some sort of weapon. The small figure racing forward to attack. It didn't really look like an attack. The man behind the rock might have thought it was an attack. Then the firing. He skimmed through the battle. Yes, it really must be the one on the banknote. What a perfectly poor transmission. They were usually so clear. Then the car, followed by horses, and the man getting up on the car and talking to a crowd and holding the small body. This was where he had to have clarity, and he didn't have it. The vocal was so interrupted by the lightning that it was just sparks. Only a few bits came through. The picture showed arms being broken out, but not used. Was it a plea for no war by the man on the car? Who had that small body been to cause all this? A prince of a reigning sovereign? Well, thankfully, the infra-beam transmission from the island country was better,
and the speech there came strong and clear. And it promised a war. But against whom? Why? It was the same man. The ship he had gotten into had been carefully tracked as it went over the pole of the planet. One could not be absolutely sure, however, that it was the same man as on the banknote. Firelight was a very long band and almost went off the bottom of the infrabeam spectrum. The small gray man sighed again. He could not be sure at all. Not sure enough for a vital critical analysis. He was just reaching for another pill when a light blinked from the people up on the flight deck. There was nothing much to do while in orbit, and a warning signal was a rarity. He tapped a button to light a screen and get the picture being relayed to him. And then he looked out the port. Ah, yes. He had half expected this. A war vessel. There it was, settling into orbit near them, bright and shining against the black sky. Always unnecessarily dramatic, these war vessels. Let's see, diamond with a slash, the insignia of the Tallnaps. He had wondered when they would arrive. He flittered a rolling, lighted list and a round indicator on his desk. Tallnap. Tallnap war cruisers. Did that one out there have a diamond-shaped bridge? Yes. Vulcor class. Vulcor specifications. Here it was. List weight 2,000 tons, solar-powered, main battery 64 Maxim blast cannons. How dull, these endless specifications. Who cared about the number of blast-type bulkheads? Complement 524 Tallnap Marines, 63 operating crew. Goodness, wouldn't one think that the computer clerks would realize the important items one would really want? Commanded by a half-captain, autonomous authority over local tactical conditions, but without authority over strategic decisions. That was what the small gray man was looking for. The local space communication buzzer went on. The small gray man turned a Vizio screen on. The hard face of a Tallnap, topped by a small shield helmet, appeared. A half-captain insignia on the helmet. The small gray man knew he was talking to the vessel's commander. The small gray man flipped a little switch so the Tallnap's screen would show his own face.
"Good spacing to you, sir," said the Tallnap. "I am Rogo Dieter Snowl."
He was speaking Cyclo, which was pretty universal. He adjusted thick glasses to better see the small gray man.
"Greetings, half-captain," said the small gray man. "Could we be of service to you?"
"Why, yes, Your Excellency. You might possibly oblige us with any vital information you might have regarding this planet."
The small gray man sighed.
"I am very much afraid, half-captain, that anything I have to give you has not yet resolved itself to critical analysis. It would not be complete, and while we are always happy to be of service, I fear we might erroneously advise you."
"Ah, well, it won't take very long to organize things here," said the Tallnap. "It's been a very long voyage, and my crew is still in deep sleep. But we can launch a party in the next few hours and obtain preliminary data."
The small gray man was afraid he would say that.
"I, of course, would not presume to thwart your intentions, half-captain, but I should think it would be very inadvisable."
"Oh? But a quick smash-bash, a few beings seized from here and there, and a rapid interrogation should give us all we need."
"Half-captain, I feel I should advise you that I do not think it would yield fruit. I have been collecting information for some time now, and have here anything you would get. I can transmit it over to you, whatever I happen to have."
"That would be very thoughtful of you, Your Excellency. But why not a quick smash-bash minor raid? I detect some thoughts on this."
"Well, as a matter of fact," said the small gray man, "you do detect some reservations, and it is very acute of you. It might be important to stand off and wait."
"Do you think they're the ones?"
asked Snowl.
"My dear fellow," said the small gray man, "I believe there are 300 different planetary suspects."
302, I think," said Snowl. "At least, that is the rumored figure."
"We cannot tell you that this is the one," said the small gray man, "and I can't give you comparative evidence about other planets and systems, for I am, of course, concerned with simply this sector, as you are.
but it is my belief, based on very thin evidence, that this just could be the one.
Oh, I say, said the tall man. That's promising.
We are not in a position to adjudicate at this time, but it could be that a raid by you might disturb what appears to be a very critical political situation down there, and possibly disturb it to our disfavor.
You're advising us to wait, then, said the tall man.
Well, yes, said the small gray man. I will send you across any file data I have been collecting, and I think you will reach the same conclusion.
It's difficult, said the tall man. No raids, no prize money is our position. But we do have this other strategic thing.
Yes, and we should not make any tactical move that might upset it.
Ah,
said the tall man. Then,
how long would you think we should delay? Days, months, years?
Months, I should think. The tall man sighed, then brightened and smiled. A tall man's smile was a bit frightening, since their fangs were poison.
All right, Your Excellency. It is very courteous of you to offer the information, and I shall be very happy to review it. By the way, can we offer you escort and protection? I should think a Hockner ship might show up, and they are quite nasty, you know.
I do, thank you, half-captain, said the small gray man wearily. But, as you know, we have no quarrel ourselves with the Hockners.
No, of course not, said the tall man. Any supplies, anything like that we can provide?
Thank you, not just now. Possibly later. Your courtesy is always appreciated.
We are already in your debt, said the tall man, and laughed. Come across for tea sometime.
He clicked off. The very thought of more tea made the small gray man's stomach hurt. He reached for another indigestion pill. All things considered, this really was the worst hardcore problem that had ever come to his desk. The indigestion pill was about to take effect when he suddenly realized that the Balbods, the Hawbins, and who knows who else might show up. He hoped they wouldn't quarrel with one another. In the situation he was in, it took months now to get proper reports home and months to hear anything. He felt very much on his own. He looked out the port again, at the gun-bristling monster of a war vessel, flashing along beside them in the glaring sunlight. Tough beings, the Tallneps, but really not much worse than Balbods or Hockners. He glanced down at the planet face below them. Was it really the one? If it were, in one way it would be a relief. But if it were, what violence could go shooting down at it? His sigh was very deep.